You really want to be better with your finances. You try to put money away in savings. You look for deals. You wrote out a budget once a long time ago. Yet you still overdraft from time to time and you still have debt. The truth is, managing money is not easy, but Rocket Money can help. Rocket Money shows you exactly what you're spending every month. From there, the app helps you make a budget that meets your financial goals. The app even gives you real-time alerts when you're about to go over your budget so you don't spend too much. With Rocket Money, you can also see all of your subscriptions at a glance and cancel the ones you don't want right from the app. Rocket Money can even try to get you a refund for some of the money you wasted. Plus, you can use the smart savings feature to start putting more money away. Rocket Money analyzes your accounts to determine the optimal time to stow away cash without going over your budget. Our members report that the Rocket Money app saved them more than $700 a year. Getting better with money doesn't have to be a pipe dream. Rocket Money can make it a reality. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play stores.
This is CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor. Here's John Batchelor.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. I welcome Bill Raggio, the senior fellow of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. He keeps the Long War Journal with his colleague Tom Jocelyn and others. Tom is not with us momentarily. He's in Washington, D.C. to testify to members of Congress. We turn to conversation between Tom Jocelyn and the Senate Armed Services Committee some days past, on the last day of September, because this testimony very neatly encapsulates all the reporting that Bill and Tom and their colleagues have done for years. What we know about Afghanistan. We're looking at a picture now after the withdrawal of the U.S. and the ISAF forces from Afghanistan. We're asking questions about what we see now and where it came from, how it connects to what we can expect to be the future for Afghanistan, for Pakistan, for the region. We begin with the news from Afghanistan, remembering always now when the Associated Press or other trusted bodies of news reporting write up what happens in Kabul or what happens after events of violence. We can only mention again and again that this is Taliban reporting to larger news sources, Taliban controlling the flow of news. This is not a transparent picture. This is nothing similar, even in the same universe, of what we had before the U.S. and ISAF withdrawal. So I read from the Associated Press, Kabul, Afghanistan. Taliban forces raided an Islamic State affiliate's hideout in the Afghan capital and killed several insurgents hours after a deadly bombing outside a mosque in Kabul. The Taliban said Monday. Sunday's bombing outside the Eidgah Mosque killed five civilians, and while no claim of responsibility was made, suspicion quickly fell on the Islamic group, which has ramped up attacks against its Taliban enemies since their takeover of Kabul in mid-August. Again, Taliban said. Further, Taliban officials had gathered at the mosque to mourn the passing of Taliban spokesman Zabihullah Mujahid's mother. Bill, a very good day to you. Thank you very much. Taliban says, Taliban says, Taliban says. What do we know about the ISIS in Afghanistan attacking the Taliban? What is the background for ISIS and Taliban? What is their enmity? Good day to you, Bill.
Good day, John. Yes, and this enmity has gone on for, I guess, 6-7 years now. The Islamic State's Khorasan province, also known as ISIS-K or ISIS Khorasan, it formed in 2014 as there were rumors that the Taliban's founder and emir, Mullah Omar, he was dead. And there was truth to that, obviously. He was dead. He died in 2013, but the Taliban leadership or elements of it concealed it from the rest of the Taliban and from the world, and basically played Weekend at Bernie's with his body. They issued press releases in his name and pretended he was alive when he was, and then the truth came out in April 2015. The Taliban admitted it, but elements of the Taliban split off. So these were disaffected Taliban leaders. Some of them joined the Islamic State, which was the Islamic State was declared in the summer 2014 after Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi announced the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria. So you had some members liking that. And then you had disaffected movement in the Taliban in Pakistan, which was, you had elements of that that were unhappy with their leadership and some members of Al-Qaeda. Typically these were unhappy commanders who felt their leadership was lying to them, or commanders who were just, and followers, by the way, who were just a little bit more, had a little bit more zeal and wanted the Islamic Emirate now as opposed to, or the Islamic State now, as opposed to this patient Taliban and Al-Qaeda strategy of not declaring the Islamic State until you're able to defend it. So in the case with the Taliban's insurgency, the Taliban isn't going to announce their Islamic Emirate until they were able to conquer all of Afghanistan. And that's what we just witnessed this summer. So this is the origin of the Islamic State. Now, of course, in Khorasan province, of course, they're in direct opposition to the Taliban. The Taliban wants to have primacy of the jihad, of the fighting inside of Afghanistan. So the two were destined to battle. And this is what we've seen over the last several years. But the reality is that the Islamic State Khorasan province never really controlled much at all in Afghanistan. Some pockets in Nangarhar and for a short period of time in Zabul and in Helmand and in some districts in northern Afghanistan and western, but it was very limited and a very short amount of time. The Taliban put down these Islamic State actions, the last bastion being in Nangarhar, and that they were defeated in 2019 with the help of the United States, by the way, a major, major mistake by the United States. And this is but they still exist. They exist at a cellular level. They're a underground terrorist organization. So they're able to conduct the, sporadic attacks. In the case of the last couple of weeks, they've launched the probably a dozen or so IED attacks in Nangarhar, Jalalabad, the capital of Nangarhar. And then this suicide bombing that you saw in Kabul, this is probably the most significant Islamic State attack since the U.S. left Afghanistan. It targeted Zabihullah Mujahid, is a significant Taliban figure. He's been their spokesman for all these years. He's been the face of the Taliban, even though we haven't really seen his face. Up until they conquered Kabul, and the targeting his mother's funeral inside of Kabul, that's a significant attack. But look, my opinion is that the Taliban over time is going to root out this network. They have the advantage of what the U.S. didn't and Kabul didn't, and that's ruthlessness. And that is ultimately what you need to go after. You need to go after the Islamic State.
A puzzle, Bill, that I do not believe is solved. The bombing that killed 13 U.S. military personnel and 169 Afghans so far, that took place during the withdrawal from Afghanistan, the Taliban blamed that on the Islamic State, and the Islamic State is said to have taken responsibility for it. The puzzle at the time and remains is how someone or ones heavily wrapped with explosives managed to get through all of the checkpoints maintained by the Taliban surrounding the airport, when many American citizens we know now and green card holders were not able to get through to the airport to evacuate. And the puzzle at the time was, how does anything happen in Kabul that the Taliban doesn't know about, given their network of spies and observers and gunmen in the area? Now, this attack on the mosque at a significant Taliban event where leadership would have been gathered, it's a puzzle, Bill, only because when we saw attacks like this happening before, it was a fair guess that there was an inside source or inside help, that there was a turncoat in some fashion that gave accurate information about where and how and who to attack. And the Taliban are very careful about anybody wrapped in explosives. So I raise that possibility, Bill, as the Taliban has used Islamic State in the past as the person to blame. Remember the bombing of that school in 2020, I believe, or the maternity hospital in 2020. And have we ever settled that question when the Taliban blames Islamic State, that it's accurate or that the Islamic State is not being used as a scapegoat for Taliban's own terror tactics?
Yeah, this question is, it remains an open question. So, you know, the short of it is the United Nations sanctions and monitoring team identified at specific times the Taliban has used Islamic State, particularly after it was defeated in 2019, that it's occasionally used the Islamic State basically as a cutout to carry out high profile terror attacks. This would give the Taliban plausible deniability, allow these attacks in the capital and other places that would destabilize the former Afghan government, while giving the Taliban plausible deniability. So what that suggests is that at least elements of the Islamic State have been co-opted or permitted or been given a permissive environment to operate in and around Kabul at times. But it doesn't necessarily mean that the Islamic State would have been fully subsumed by the Taliban. I think this was, you know, this, my read on this is, again, a complex arrangement that, you know, a transactional relationship between the Taliban, particularly it was reported that members of the Haqqani network, the Haqqanis obviously, you know, being one of the most powerful Taliban factions and very strong in eastern Afghanistan. It's one of its top leaders, also is the interior minister and the deputy emir for the Taliban. So that's the environment that exists. But once the Taliban take power, the Taliban really don't have use for the Islamic State as they did in the past. So the question becomes, well, what happens to them? What happens to this relationship? We don't know the answers to any of this. And since we probably won't for quite some time, given that we have no presence now in Afghanistan, and it's going to be extremely difficult to try to figure out what is how this relationship has developed. I'm guessing, and you know, this is my educated guess on following the region, that the Taliban is working to co-opt members of the Islamic State, and they have a very powerful message. They defeated the United States, and they've taken over Afghanistan. So they're probably co-opting who they can co-opt. And those who are unwilling to do so, the diehards of the Islamic State, and they're very likely are many, they're going to wind up battling it out with the Taliban. And this is how, this is probably what we're, not probably, this is what we're seeing, right? Now, as far as how, you know, in the case of the bombing at the airport, John, where the 13 U.S. military personnel were killed. So, you know, look, I have no doubt, you know, I can't prove it, but I have no doubt that the Taliban gave a permissive environment for the Islamic State to operate in that area. That area was flooded with Taliban fighters, and not just your average Taliban fighter, but very well-trained fighters who've been trained in suicide tactics by the Haqqani network. That's Badri 313. Their special operations unit, their martyrdom brigades, however you want to define them. You know, civilian targets like this mosque, the security probably isn't quite as high, although I do agree with you. You would think the Taliban would greater secure this, but they are in many ways. We don't know, given that the Taliban's directing the reporting on this, we don't really know how this attack was carried out. Was it a bomb planted in a car? Was it a suicide bomber with a vest? Was it a bomb planted, you know, in a trash can? We don't really know what happened here. And the likelihood is we never will, because the Taliban, as you noted in your opening, controls the media. So it makes analyzing these events all the more difficult.
Bill Raggio of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracy. He's a senior fellow. He and Tom Jocelyn and their colleagues keep the Long War Journal. We're discussing what we know now about Afghanistan, and we're also incorporating remarks made by Tom Jocelyn before the Senate Armed Services Committee, most recently, on the last day of September, about Afghanistan, about the situation going forward. So when we come back, Al-Qaeda. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. CBS, Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor with Bill Raggio, the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies, senior fellow. He and his colleague Tom Jocelyn and their colleagues keep the Long War Journal. We're looking in particular at Afghanistan now because Tom Jocelyn is not with us today, testifying before Congress last week and again this week about Al-Qaeda, about the Taliban, about Afghanistan. We look to Tom's remarks to the Senate Armed Services Committee these last days about Al-Qaeda. I read from the testimony. Al-Qaeda's senior leadership has praised the Taliban's historic victory in Afghanistan. The decades-long brotherhood between the Taliban and al-Qaeda remains unbroken. Al-Qaeda fought alongside the Taliban for nearly 20 years to defeat the U.S.-backed government. Al-Qaeda groups across Africa, the Middle East, South Asia are trumpeting the Taliban's victory as a boon for the global jihadist cause. Al-Qaeda's branches, such as al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, Shababs in Somalia, and groups in Syria, view the Taliban's Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan as a model for their own nascent jihadist states. Key al-Qaeda leaders around the globe began their careers during the reign of the Taliban's first emirate. Al-Qaeda's global leader, Ayman al-Zawahiri, has an unbroken pledge of allegiance to the Taliban's Emir of the Faithful, who is now the head of state in Afghanistan. Bill, Tom has testified to the Senate the facts that you and Tom have compiled over the years. At this point, what do you want to say to the American people listening to us about al-Qaeda in Afghanistan? Is this their victory as well as the Taliban's victory, Bill?
Yeah, John, that is absolutely correct. Tom stated this in his fantastic testimony and question and answer center session at the Senate Armed Service Committee, and I wholeheartedly agree. Tom and I share a brain on this issue. Al-Qaeda played a significant role in this victory, not just in the final battles where, you know, Tom and I discussed the Al-Qaeda's importance in the fight in the north, the fight in the east, and its support for the Taliban, or helping organize this offensive, help getting some disparate jihadist groups to fight under the Taliban's banner. But over the last 20 years, the Taliban and Al-Qaeda have remained allied, and this was a strategic, not just a tactical alliance in order for that the Taliban used to just help regain control, but it's a strategic alliance because in the end they share the same goals. And it is without a doubt a victory for Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda now has a safe haven in Afghanistan with the protection of the state. U.S. efforts to launch what they call over-the-horizon strikes, I would describe these strikes as over-the-horizon or over-the-rainbow, without the ability to gather on-the-ground intelligence, which is going to be extremely limited. There's no more Afghan military and police. There's no National Directorate of Security to provide information, intelligence, bases for the U.S. to operate. And honestly, what Afghan in his right mind is going to provide intelligence to the United States when the Taliban is everywhere and their intelligence and counterintelligence forces are looking to root out those who would help the United States and the West. So Al-Qaeda has safe haven here, and they have the protection of the Taliban state. The Taliban stated just this week, or just last week, that U.S. strikes are not permitted, aren't permitted by that Doha deal that the Taliban wants to stick with, and that U.S. officials keep mentioning as being invalid. That deal does state that the U.S. does not have the capability or the permission to conduct attacks.
This is February of 2020, that agreement you were referring to.
That is correct, John. Yes, the February 29th, 2020 Doha deal signed by the Trump administration.
So what we have here is Afghanistan, Taliban, and Al-Qaeda working together today, right now. Bill, final question in this segment, because we're going to turn to the Taliban in control in Kabul. Did Al-Qaeda ever leave Afghanistan, as was the general impression given by several administrations? Was it ever not there? We have about a minute.
Yeah, this idea that Al-Qaeda is decimated, defeated, degraded, pick your D word, also a shell of itself, a shade of itself, or gone, as President Biden stated. All of that was untrue. Tom and I documented this over the past decade plus. Al-Qaeda maintained a robust presence inside of Afghanistan. And this wasn't just Tom and I, my analysis. The United Nations Security Council sanctions and monitoring team also noted this. The U.S. military and the U.S. government stated that Al-Qaeda was a shell of itself inside of Afghanistan in order to justify withdrawal. This was a falsehood perpetuated under three administrations in order to permit the, after all, the U.S. can't leave if Al-Qaeda, the Al-Qaeda-Taliban relationship is strong and Al-Qaeda has a significant presence in Afghanistan. But the Biden administration did so anyway.
Bill Rajow, Senior Fellow, Foundation for the Defense of Democracies with Tom Justin, keeps the Long War Journal. When we come back, Taliban in command. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor with Bill Raggio, Senior Fellow, Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. He and Tom Justin and their colleagues keep the Long War Journal, a record of the vast Ummah, the vast jihadist effort from the Mediterranean to the Hindu Kush. We're focusing on Afghanistan. Tom has testified before the Senate Armed Services Committee and others in these last days about what we know about Pakistan, Afghanistan, Taliban, Al-Qaeda, ISIS, all of that, what we know now. We're looking forward, not back. There's plenty of time for the history books. But what is the threat? What is the threat to the region? What is the threat to Eurasia and to the United States? We also mentioned that hundreds, perhaps thousands of Afghan citizens have now exited Afghanistan and are on their way to the EU or other safe havens, or are already in the United States or processing to come to the United States. This is a record of what their country looks like now, going forward. Remember most recently, a member of the Hmong tribe from Vietnam, a young woman from Minnesota, won a gold medal at the Olympics. So this is generations after, two generations after the Vietnam War. Those Afghan citizens who are now American citizens or near to will have need for the facts of what the Taliban is now, what was left behind and what goes forward. All of this is in a mix of history that will be written about for at least 100 years, if not more. So we go to what we know now about the Taliban in Kabul. I follow Tom's testimony for the Senate Armed Services Committee. Tom speaks. The Taliban's new regime is just its old regime. Many of the Taliban's cabinet ministers are veterans of the Taliban First Islamic Emirate from 96 to 2001. More than one dozen of them have already been sanctioned by the United Nations, including for their ties to terrorism. All five of the former Guantanamo detainees who were exchanged for Sergeant Bo Bergdahl in 2014, now serve the Taliban in senior leadership roles. Bill, I turn to you. What we know so far about the Taliban and how it's ruling in Kabul. I've seen some photographs of women in complete body covering, but again, the reporting depends upon the Taliban, which makes it inexact. What do we know? What do you observe about the Taliban and the way it's conducting itself here in 2021?
Yeah, and John, the point that meet the new Taliban, same as the old Taliban, this can't be stressed enough, because you have to remember the old Taliban brought us Al-Qaeda in 9/11. Nearly every minister in the current regime is served from 96 at some point in time from 96 to 2001. And if it isn't one of them, it's someone like Sirajuddin Haqqani, who is the son of one of those individuals who served during that regime. And not that Siraj could be even more radical than his father, Jalaluddin, but he's as radical as his father, or Mullah Omar's son, Mullah Yaqub, all cut from the same cloth. This cannot be stressed enough. And so as this is your leadership, so is Afghanistan is devolving into what it was from 1996 to 2001 and didn't take any time at all. For instance, the Taliban disbanded the women's ministry and replaced it in the same building with the Ministry of Propagation of Virtue and Prevention of Vice. That's the goon squad that goes out and enforces the Taliban's harsh version of Sharia. We are seeing some videos coming out of beatings of women and of former government officials, of journalists. This is what's sneaking out in social media, of even people having their hands chopped off for theft, or people, members of former security forces under the Afghan government being hung in the squares in cities. So we're seeing this. We're seeing the old Taliban regime become the new Taliban regime. Nothing has change, John. It's just, it's the same old Taliban. We were fed a lie by a bunch of apologists and people that had wishful thinking about a moderated Taliban, a Taliban 2.0. This was another idea of just like the idea that Al-Qaeda did wasn't present there. The idea of a moderate Taliban was sold to us by Taliban apologists who wanted the U.S. to leave Afghanistan and hand it over to the Taliban.
The Taliban, and this is Tom's testimony and remarks you and Tom have made to me over the years, but I want to review this because where we are now, the Taliban today, Bill, do they continue to blame the United States for the 9/11 hijackings? Is that their explanation?
Yeah, the Taliban is doing two things. First, it's denying, its spokesmen are denying that Al-Qaeda had a role in 9/11. They're telling us, we don't have any evidence of this. And then at the same time, they rub it in our face and say we deserved it. Is a slap on our dark face. That's one quote from the Taliban statement a couple of years ago. And that type of information continues. They keep putting it out. That even as they deny having any role in 9/11 or even Al-Qaeda having a role in 9/11, they tell us we deserve it.
Also, the Taliban today, puzzlingly, the Taliban today tells a story about Osama bin Laden that is at odds with another story that's told about the Bush administration's pursuit of Osama bin Laden in 2001 after the attack on the U.S. in Washington. The story that I have heard repeatedly over the years, Bill, is that the Taliban, led by Mullah Omar, was ready to give up Osama bin Laden to the Bush administration. And U.S. officials either didn't hear or didn't want to hear that and went ahead with the attack on Afghanistan. This is October of 2001. What do we understand about Mullah Omar, Osama bin Laden, and now the leader of the man who replaced Mullah Omar? What did they say about Osama bin Laden?
Yeah, this is another set of revisionist history that are pushed the narrative by both the Taliban and Taliban apologists. It's completely false. Mullah Omar came out in late September of 2001 and gave an interview to, I believe it was Voice of America, and openly stated that they would not turn over Osama bin Laden. And that they would fight and they will fight against the U.S. and God will show who deserves to win. And Omar said, we think it's us. We know it's us. We have faith that it will be us. Jalaluddin Haqqani, the son of, Sirajuddin, said the same thing. He was assigned to defend, to protect Osama bin Laden after he left Afghanistan. And he said the same thing, that the Taliban would not turn over Osama bin Laden. So this narrative won't die. It's put out there in order to weaken the claim that the United States had to go into Afghanistan. Because the reality is that the U.S., whatever we think of what happened in Afghanistan of the 20 years since entering there, there was no way to attempt to get Osama bin Laden. And remember, the strike that killed him, the raid that killed him in 2011 took place from, and he was killed in Pakistan, of course. But that raid was launched from Afghanistan and from intelligence that was gathered over the years across the border. So, yeah, this is one of the more frustrating things that Tom and I run into. It's repeated as if it's fact when it's complete fiction.
Another detail about the Taliban today, repeatedly, and these are anecdotes, we don't have transparency anymore. Repeatedly, I hear stories of Afghans who are in hiding from the Taliban regime because of their supposed work with the Americans or ISAF, because they speak English, because they were translators, because they have a cousin or a brother or a husband who are working with the Americans. Do you hear these stories as well, Bill, in hiding? Is it possible to be in hiding from the Taliban in Afghanistan?
Yes, I'm hearing these stories, and then these stories are without a doubt true. We're seeing evidence that individuals are being targeted and killed or beaten by the Taliban for relationships with the U.S. or the West, for working with the Afghan government. As far as how are they doing this, well, Kabul and other, they're big cities. And, you know, the Taliban as effective as they are, they aren't everywhere. They can't be everywhere. So if you're, if you have enough contacts, if you're on the move, you can avoid them. But, that is a losing proposition over the time as the, over time as the Taliban consolidates its gains, consolidates its rules, its rule, it will become more and more difficult to avoid them.
And finally about the Taliban, because again, we don't have transparency. There was a presentation towards the end of the U.S. ISAF presence in Kabul that the Taliban may be available to work with the United States to strike against elements of Al-Qaeda if they reconstitute themselves. There are a lot of ifs here. Or ISIS if they prove a problem to the region. Is that something that you've seen in fact, Bill, the Taliban giving information or coordinating with U.S. officials about threats to the region, threats to Kabul, threats to Pakistan or the region?
Well, Secretary CENTCOM Commander General McKenzie has called, or at least the door while the U.S. was there, called the Taliban our partners and was talking with them and apparently trying to coordinate with them. There's a lot, you know, he denies it, but there's a lot of belief out there and that that strike that killed the 10 civilians in part had information that was supplied by the Taliban. It would make a lot of sense for the Taliban to set the United States up with one final humiliating strike that killed civilians. I think the Taliban would be more than happy to accept U.S. support to defeat the Islamic State. After all, they accepted it back in from 2017, 18, 19, when the U.S. was basically serving as the Taliban's air force in Nangarhar, even as Al-Qaeda was fighting alongside it. Now, would the Taliban target Al-Qaeda? Absolutely not. Remember, Secretary Pompeo said after the February 29, 2020 Doha deal was signed that the Taliban would, quote, destroy Al-Qaeda, end quote. The number of Al-Qaeda killed, captured, or wounded by the Taliban since that statement is zero, and I don't expect that number to rise. The Taliban and Al-Qaeda, again, are allied. Would the U.S. like the Taliban to provide intelligence on Al-Qaeda? Sure, but that will never happen. And even if the Taliban turned around tomorrow and said, hey, we have information on Al-Qaeda operating in Afghanistan, which, by the way, the Taliban says isn't even there, the U.S. should be highly suspect of it. You would immediately suspect of being set up to kill civilians in order to make the United States, to embarrass and humiliate the United States.
I'm speaking with Bill Roggio, the senior fellow, Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. He and Tom Jocelyn and their colleagues keep the Long War Journal, which is a chronology of these many decades. And when we come back, one particular family, the Haqqani family, the Haqqani network, originally of Pakistan, now in two camps, or three. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
CBS, Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor with Bill Roggio, the senior fellow at the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies, with Tom Jocelyn and their colleagues. They keep the Long War Journal. Bill and Tom also do Generation Jihad, their podcast, highly recommended, backwards and forwards. It'll give you the history of where we are right now, which is through a glass darkly into Afghanistan. There is no transparency whatsoever with the reporting. However, we have the record of what the Taliban has said, what it does, anecdotes coming out, and we have the Haqqani network. The Haqqani network is critical to understand. There's no comparable example I can think of in American history because the Haqqani family operates in Pakistan as sometimes opponent of the Pakistan government that sponsors the Taliban. It operates in Afghanistan as a helpmate, a very sophisticated helpmate to the Taliban. It also has an integral relationship with Al-Qaeda in the region, globally, a reputation, and it's based on one man who's no longer with us. Bill, who was Jalaluddin Haqqani? What did he achieve in his lifetime, and who is his successor in the Haqqani network?
Yeah, Jalaluddin Haqqani started his career as a Mujahideen commander against the Soviets. He was part of the Khalis network in Afghanistan, but he quickly rose to prominence. He had a base in North, where still the Haqqani family still has a base in North Waziristan, a tribal agency in North, in northwestern Pakistan. He quickly grew to support the global jihadist cause and had deep ties with foreign terrorists, particularly the Arabs that ultimately made up Al-Qaeda. He ran training camps for them in the region, both during the jihad against the against the Soviets, and in the 1990s he joined ranks with the Taliban as the Taliban was marching to take control of Afghanistan in the early to mid 1990s. He became a minister within the Taliban's government. After he's played a crucial role, one of the three key figures that got Osama bin Laden into Afghanistan after he was ejected from the Sudan. And since then, he died of natural causes in 2018, but he was a member of the Taliban's top central leadership council. And his son is Sirajuddin Haqqani, who became the head of one of the key military shuras or military councils, the Muharram Shah Shura, named after the town in North Waziristan. He became the operational leader of the Haqqani network in the late 2000s, early 2010s. And he rose to the prominence to become a deputy. This is Sirajuddin now, who became one of two deputy emirs for the Taliban, the other being Mullah Omar's son. And now Sirajuddin is not only is a deputy emir, but he is the interior minister. This is arguably the most important post in the Taliban's government. He's appointing the governors for the provinces and also organizes the internal security forces for the Taliban and does things like control its intelligence networks. Sirajuddin probably would be the real military commander, the man responsible for the plan for the Taliban's offensive that took over the country. Again, he's a specially designated global terrorist for the Haqqani network is a terrorist organization. It's designated for ties to Al-Qaeda. Just about there's 16 members of the Haqqani clan that have been designated, and I think 14 of the 16 explicitly mentioned Al-Qaeda as their support for Al-Qaeda. And Sirajuddin has been named by the United Nations Security Council as being a leader within Al-Qaeda. If the deputy emir of the Taliban and its interior minister is also an Al-Qaeda leader, what does that make the Taliban? These are the questions that no one in the U.S. government really is asking, let alone trying to answer. But the implications of this are staggering. And this is why when Tom and I say Al-Qaeda has safe haven and support of the state, elements of that Taliban state are actually part of Al-Qaeda. And this is why everyone should be losing sleep. If what happened in Afghanistan stayed in Afghanistan, it was just a little brush war. We could ignore it and move on and just, you know, it would be a stinging defeat. But what we have here in Afghanistan is far, far more complicated and far more concerning. And the Haqqanis play a humongous role in as to why this is problematic.
A detail about Sirajuddin Haqqani, now a member of the Taliban cabinet, leader of the family. Tom reports, and you have reported, that he actively protected Hamza bin Laden, Osama bin Laden's son, who was being prepared to be the leader of the Al-Qaeda network. He was killed in a drone strike several years past, I believe. And the Sirajuddin Haqqani is entirely disposed to protecting as many members of Al-Qaeda as possible anywhere they are in the region. Is that correct, Bill?
That is correct. I tracked the U.S. drone strikes in Afghanistan from 2004 to 2000, and they pretty much ended in 2017. And 95% of the strikes took place in North and South Waziristan. And the areas in North Waziristan where the strikes took place, nearly all of them were in territory controlled by the Haqqani family. And routinely, senior and mid-level and Al-Qaeda leaders, operatives, bomb makers, things like that were killed alongside Haqqani members. So the Haqqanis played an instrumental role in protecting Al-Qaeda and sheltering Al-Qaeda, even during that deadly drone campaign that was taking place in Pakistan.
And our final remarks here, because Tom is testifying before Congress and all of this material is available through the congressional record. Bill, your understanding of reporting out of Afghanistan, is there any ones or more sources that we can now depend upon? We no longer have CENTCOM. I read from the AP report this morning. Is that now the best we can do into Kabul? We have about 30 seconds.
Yeah, this is the dark hole that Afghanistan has become. The vibrant Afghan press has been suppressed by the PAK. It's become part of the Taliban. There are independent reporters, but they're reliant on the Taliban to give them access. The best we can do is look at what's being put up on social media by people with phones that still have internet access, but that's going to continue to dry up as well.
Bill Raja, Senior Fellow, Foundation for the Defense of Democracy, along with Tom Jocelyn and their colleagues. They keep the Long War Journal. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Bash.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
This is Matt Rogers from Las Culturistas with Matt Rogers and Bowen Yang.
This is Bowen Yang from Los Culturistas with Matt Rogers and Bowen Yang.
Hey, Bowen. It's gift season.
Ugh, stressing me out. Why are the people I love so hard to shop for?
Probably because they only make boring gift guides that are totally uninspired. Except for the guide we made.
In partnership with Marshalls, where premium gifts meet incredible value.
It's giving gifts! With categories like best gifts for the mom whose idea of a sensible walking shoe is a stiletto.
Or best gifts for me that were so thoughtful I really shouldn't have.
Check out the guide on Marshalls.com.
And gift the good stuff at Marshalls.
You ain't heard about Moto Casino? Moto has real Vegas slots. Any game you can find on the floor in Vegas, you can play it on Moto. I like my slots hot. Moto's free to play, like food stamps. In line at the grocery store, at a funeral, in traffic. Keep your eyes on the road. Hop on Moto Casino. Moto Casino got jackpots that are bigger than my belly. Moto, America's hottest free-to-play social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today. Moto Casino is the social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
At CVS, it matters that we're not just in your community, but that we're part of it. It matters that we're here for you when you need us, day or night. And we want everyone to feel welcomed and rewarded. It matters that CVS is here to fill your prescriptions and here to fill your craving for a tasty and, yeah, healthy snack. At CVS, we're proud to serve your community because we believe where you get your medicine matters. So visit us at CVS.com or just come by our store. We can't wait to meet you. Store hours vary by location.